The Guardian. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. On this week's podcast...
Our brains are already so strange and wondrous. I can't believe that people aren't walking around the street and talking about this all the time, about what's going on in there.
Why doesn't our brain allow us to know what's going on inside it?
Most of what you believe and think and how you act, you don't have any real acquaintance with why you're doing it.
Are prejudices hardwired into us?
There's no reason to imagine that he can't be both. That he can't have parts of his brain that are anti-Semitic and really lousy in their behavior, and other parts that are more into long-term thinking and bigger social contexts and are not.
Our guest, David Eagleman, proposes a different approach to criminal justice.
What you'd really want to do is predicate sentencing on the probability that somebody will reoffend.
We pose another pretty unanswerable question.
It governs our lives. It's what gives us a poignancy to existence.
Plus, we climb on board Vostok 1. And hitch a ride alongside Yuri Gagarin, exactly 50 years to the second since he made history.
Hearing the excitement in his voice all these years on, connected with the pictures and with a beautiful new musical score, I'm really pleased to say that I think it really is spellbinding.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back. Alok's away somewhere, so I'm in charge of the podcast this week. So I decided to invite a rather interesting chap into our studios.
You're just testing sound here, yeah? I had eggs for breakfast, followed by a cup of tea.
David Eagleman is one of the world's leading experts in three separate fields of neuroscience. He focuses on synesthesia, neurolaw, and time perception.
How are your lockets?
My lockets?
You're battling through with them.
This is not an American brand. I didn't recognize the word when you said it.
Unfortunately, his voice was hanging by a thread, but we plied him with throat lozenges and a special Guardian hot chocolate, and he soldiered on.
So because this is being edited anyway, right?
David Eagleman directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action and the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law.
Is this the real identification, or this is... I'm an assistant professor of neuroscience at Baylor College of Medicine.
That's in Houston, Texas.
All right.
His latest book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. So I began by asking him about this secret life.
Well, what got me really interested in neuroscience was that almost all of the brain's operations are happening under the hood, and you don't have any access to them. And this is essentially everything that's going on in your life. So, for example, if you imagine moving your arm, it seems totally effortless, right? But in fact, it's underpinned by a lightning storm of electrical activity in the brain. You don't have access to any of that. And in fact, people who aren't biologists wouldn't even have any reason to suspect the existence of muscles and tendons and nerves and electrical signals traveling down nerve bundles. It just seems like you move your arm and there it is. Well, it turns out that everything in your life is like that. So whether it's putting hot chocolate to your lips or recognizing a friend or driving a car or falling in love, all of these things are happening under the hood. You don't have any access to them. And, you know, at some point I started to realize that the conscious me that was asking all these questions is the smallest bit of what's happening in the brain. It turns out this is not so much depressing as completely amazing to me because there's a whole inner cosmos going on there in your skull. And exactly in analogy to the way we look out from our planet and try to understand how vast and wondrous the cosmos is outside of us, we're just at this point in history where we're peering inside now and realizing it's not just sort of the simple thing that's going on. It's the most complicated device we have ever found in the universe, and it's inside our skulls, and it's us.
Can you give us an example of one of those sort of unconscious things that you don't think about, the one of the surprising ones?
Well, here's an example. There was a study where men were shown photographs of women's faces and asked to rank the attractiveness. And unbeknownst to the men, one half of the photographs had the women had their eyes dilated. And in the other half, they were not dilated. And the men overwhelmingly found the women with the dilated eyes to be more attractive. But the thing is, none of them had access to why. None of them said, well, I noticed her pupils were 2 millimeters larger here than here. And none of them were consciously aware that dilated eyes are a sign of sexual readiness in a female. And yet their brains picked up on it. They knew, and they were driven towards that. It turns out that all the things we feel like, oh, that person is attractive to me, or I'm scared of that person, or I think I should do this for my career, or I think I shouldn't do that. These things get really processed and consolidated in the brain over days or weeks or years. And then we just get served up with a feeling of it. And so in that sense, our conscious life is like the headline of a newspaper, where all we're getting is the summary, the headline, and all of the details that are happening in a nation, you know, with the cars driving and the handshakes and the police and the cranes and the whatever, like all, we don't care about any of that detail. And it's the same with consciousness, not having access to the details of the brain. It just gets a summary of it.
So, and I like this analogy of the newspaper and the nation. And I'm just wondering how that fits with the relationship of neuroscience to philosophy. So philosophy is essentially, by your analogy, the study over centuries of the newspapers without really any understanding of the fact that they're reporting on a country. But neuroscientists are starting to effectively, they're looking at the motorways and they're looking at the kinds of interactions and the laws that exist in that country. They're trying to look at the things that make up those headlines. How does that work? How do you interact with philosophers?
I think neuroscience and philosophy complement each other. I mean, some people view it as neuroscience is taking over philosophy. I don't think that's quite right, because if you were just studying the headlines of a nation, there would be things that you could pick up on that you couldn't pick up if you were just studying the highways and motorways. So when you study the headlines of the nation, you get senses of political cycles and the economy and so on. And when you're studying the motorway, you get the sense of what sort of makes all that stuff happen on a bigger level, but not in detail. So the challenge I think that neuroscience faces is that essentially the whole field is very reductionistic or materialistic, which means we go into lab every day with the assumption that by studying enough of the pieces and parts and getting smaller and smaller and understanding how every molecule is interacting with every other molecule, that we will come to have an understanding of the big picture. But there's no real guarantee of that. And in fact, there are times when that seems a little bit unlikely. The important thing to understand is not just the little parts, but the emergent properties that happen when you stick lots of little parts together in very specific ways. And then, of course, there's this open question. We just don't know the answer to this, but it's this open question of, can you build conscious experience from pieces and parts, from physical pieces and parts? If I gave you 100 billion Tinker Toys and asked you to put them together in any crazy pattern you want, where this leads to that, and that's a lever, and that's a pulley, the question is, how would you put these things together so that at some point you could say, okay, now it's experiencing the taste of feta cheese. It's having the private subjective experience of that.
But you can't even do that between two individuals, let alone between a model and a human.
So what you're pointing out is you can't know if another individual is conscious or not. But that's not so important, because we know we're conscious, right? I mean, if you know that you're conscious, then that makes it a valid scientific question to ask, how am I conscious? What is it about the fact that I seem to be equivalent to this vast, wet, electrical, mechanical, chemical network called the nervous system? How is it that I'm sort of equivalent to the nervous system, and yet I have private subjective experience? I mean, let's do this another way. Is the city of London conscious? After all, it's made up of power lines and electricity lines and sewage lines and handshakes and people kissing on the cheek. And there's all sorts of pieces and parts that interact with one another.
In a way that you could say is analogous to what's going on in the brain.
Well, that's the question. The question is having a bunch of pieces and parts together sufficient for consciousness? Probably not. It's probably got to be the right programs that are running on top of those pieces and parts. I mean,
with the programs that are running. How does that work?
Well, if I were to take a billion transistors and stuff them at the bottom of a shoebox, that wouldn't be my laptop. It's just the pieces and parts of it. They have to be organized in the right way. And what we don't know is what the secret of the brain is, how that microcircuitry is organized such that it gives rise to consciousness. The deep mystery, though, is we don't actually know if we're barking up the right tree. I mean, we have no other choice. There's no other tree to bark up. But
what do you think there might be?
Let me do it this way. We don't have a theory of how physical pieces and parts can ever lead to private subjective experience. There's no way that I could come back here a year from now and say, hey, look, I figured it out. If you do a triple integral here and you take the energy and times time and you carry the two, that's feta cheese, right? That it does. The languages don't interact. And so what that means is we're in a position where we don't even know what a theory of consciousness could look like. And that's a weird position to be in. That means that we're clearly in the infancy of this field, and there are whole giant things that we don't know yet. I think a way to look at this is if you were to look back at any period of science, go 200 years ago, we think, oh, those poor slobs, they didn't know anything about this or that. They didn't quantum mechanics, they didn't know about, they didn't know much about optics, right? They didn't know about the equivalence of mass and energy. They didn't know about electromagnetic radiation. So, you know, gosh, how could they? They made theories about everything, but they were doomed to be incorrect.
Or possibly not fundamentally descriptive or not fundamentally explanatory, maybe.
Well, that's right. I mean, just imagine trying to understand the spread of disease before you had the concept of germs, or how a muscle contracts before you have the concept of electricity. Or just look at the fact that when people tried to understand how a heart worked, they made up things for hundreds of years before the pump was invented.
Well, they realized about the pump.
And then they said, oh, the heart's a pump. But until you have that concept as part of your toolbox, you're dead in the water. And that's, I think, the situation that we're in currently, where we don't see any way to take cells in the brain, which are just like cells anywhere else in your body. They're just, you know, they're just these plasma membranes with a nucleus inside, with a DNA inside, trafficking millions of proteins. That's all a cell is. And you just got lots and lots of these interacting. And we don't know how to turn that into something where we say, oh yeah, now it's having conscious experience.
How can neuroscience affect things like our study of ethics, or the study of how we make decisions about laws, or how we make decisions about, particularly about personal responsibility?
Yeah. Well, it turns out, even though we've just been discussing consciousness, the really interesting part to me at this moment in my career is unconsciousness, is all the stuff happening under the hood, and the fact that your conscious brain has access to so little of what's going on. And when you look at the lessons of biology from the last 60 years, what you find is that the way your brain is right now is a very complicated interaction between genes and environment. So you come to the table with particular genetic predispositions, and then every experience you have changes how your genes express, changes the wiring of your brain. These things change your future behaviors. These things intertwine in this incredibly complex way. And your in utero environment, whether your mother is drinking alcohol or doing cocaine or something, that matters. Your childhood experiences, whether you're abused, that matters. The point I want to make here is that you don't choose any of that. So by the time you're a young adult, the way that your brain is wired up is largely out of your control. Now, there may be free will. This is an old debate about whether free will exists or not. My conclusion in the book is that we do not know enough to conclude one way or the other. It's a very difficult question. We can't assert that one or the other is true. But here's what we can say. If free will does exist, it is a small player in the massive operations of the brain. Meaning, because of your genes and all your experiences leading up to this point, free will has some range in which it can modulate your behavior, but if you take you and let's say some guy across town who is really aggressive and hurts people and is a lawbreaker, your brain and his brain aren't the same at all. Brains are more like fingerprints where, you know, we've all got them, but they're quite different. And so you can't look at his actions and say, well, I wouldn't have chosen to do that with my free will, because he's got a really different brain. And if you didn't have those genes and the in utero cocaine poisoning and the childhood abuse and so on, your brain and his brain aren't the same.
So what does that mean for our societal laws?
So it does not exculpate people. We're still going to put that guy in jail. If he's going around hurting people, we still have to get him off the streets. But what this does mean is, as we have a better biological understanding of people's brains, how people have a very wide distribution in terms of their capacity for decision-making, their capacity to simulate the future, to understand consequences, things like this, what it means is that we don't have to treat incarceration as a one-size-fits-all solution as ham-handedly as we do currently with sentencing guidelines and so on. What it means is that we can have customized sentencing. Some people are much more dangerous than others. There's a whole spectrum. And what you'd really want to do is predicate sentencing on the probability of recidivism, the probability that somebody will reoffend.
So you're taking punishment as a treatment for rehabilitation or for protection of society rather than in some way fault or punishment.
That's exactly right. One of the big questions in the legal system has always rested on this issue of culpability. So what happens all the time in courts is a defense lawyer comes in and says, okay, look, you know, in the fact-finding phase of the trial, it's clear that my client is guilty, but he came to the table with these genes and he was abused as a child and so on. And so then the judge and jury, everyone's asking themselves the question, okay, how much was it his fault and how much was it his biology's fault? And the problem is there's no meaningful difference in those two questions. If he is a product of his biology, then it's a completely nonsensical question to say, is it him or his biology? So I think the only right way for the legal system to operate is forward-looking instead of backward-looking. Who cares if it's his fault? Who cares if we can or cannot untangle how he got there? It's the wrong question to ask because it's way too complicated. We will never be able to untangle how somebody got there. All we need to do is say, what's the risk of reoffense here? We need, given everything that we can know about his behavior and his brain, all we need to do is say, okay, what's our best risk assessment? And if this guy is really dangerous, let's put him away for longer. If he's not so dangerous, let's put him away for a shorter time. And this opens up the opportunity for us really to think about rehabilitation. Instead of putting everybody in the revolving door of prison, we can say, all right, look, what can we do to help here? For example, the prison system has become our de facto mental health care system. It's difficult to make the estimate exactly, but an average estimate is that a third of people in prison have mental illness. Well, it's much more humane and much more cost-effective to route them to mental health courts and treatment, exactly, instead of incarcerating them.
So we ditch retribution altogether.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there's still an importance to having deterrence and so on, and in fact, incarceration is exactly the right thing to do for some people. I mean, it's the original rewire your brain strategy. You know, we're going to lock you away from
put you in a small room and take you away from your influences.
Exactly. And, you know, so if your brain is functioning normally, then incarceration is a punishment. It's a deterrence. It's all useful things. It is its own style of rehabilitation if it causes you to not want to go back there. But that's only for the people whose brains are working normally. And for those who aren't, it's not even humane to incarcerate someone who just doesn't get it and their brain's not rewiring appropriately.
What do you think is, in particular, what are you most interested in terms of unconscious processes and particularly how they relate to kind of conscious feelings or perceptions?
Here's the part of this book that I feel is really new, and I really was able to synthesize lots of data from different areas and put together a framework. And I call this the Team of Rivals framework. And the idea is you are not one thing. You are made up of all kinds of competing neural subpopulations that are all battling it out to control the single output channel of your behavior. So you're like a parliament. You've got all these political parties that are battling it out, trying to steer the ship of state. And this is why you can argue with yourself and cuss at yourself and cajole yourself and contract with yourself, because you're not one thing. I mean, who's talking to whom when you're cussing at yourself, right? You're lots of things. And what I suggest in the book is that, you know, just like a parliament, just like different political parties, you can have lots of different parties who all love their country but go about things in very different ways. It's sort of the same thing. You've got all these brain mechanisms that think they know what the right thing to do is in any situation. You know, they have to battle it out. So let's say I put a chocolate chip cookie in front of you. Part of you says, oh, I want that. It's a high glucose energy source. And part of you says, no, I'm going to get fat. Don't eat it. And they get to battle it out to see who wins. And, you know, depending on your state of mind and so on, one party might win sometimes and the other might win sometimes, but they're both you.
You say in the book, is there such a thing as a real Mel Gibson? Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah, well, I just thought it was interesting when I watched what happened with Mel Gibson several years ago now. You know, he was driving in LA and got pulled over for drunk driving, and he went on this anti-Semitic rant to the cop, and said all these things about Jews and said to the cop, "Are you a Jew?" And it turned out the cop was a Jew and noticed that there was, you know, an empty bottle of tequila on Mel's seat and measured his blood alcohol level, which was out of the roof. And the Mel wouldn't get into the cop car because the officer was Jewish. And, you know, anyway, the officer wrote up a written report. Somehow that got leaked to a celebrity website about 19 hours later. And suddenly the whole world knew about what Mel had done. Okay, so the next day, he gives out this apology about, you know, how sorry he felt about everything. And it turns out that a couple of Mel's friends are Jewish. He just spent the whole afternoon over at their house. And he said, in a way that appeared quite genuine, "I'm not an anti-Semite, and I know there's no excuse for behavior like that. I should have never, you know, I'm mortified that I said something like that." So then what happened is everybody debated about whether Mel is an anti-Semite or not. Well, what strikes me from the neuroscience point of view is there's no reason to imagine that he can't be both, that he can't have parts of his brain that are anti-Semitic and really lousy in their behavior, and other parts that are more into long-term thinking and bigger social contexts and are not. And I don't think that we have to conclude in the end that he is one or the other, even though his detractors and his supporters will always defend one position or the other. And this is, I think, an illustration about this team of rivals idea, which is that people can be quite different at different times due to alcohol or fatigue or high stress or emotion or other things. It unmasks different parts in people. And so in some sense, people are much more nuanced and sophisticated than the boxes that we sometimes want to place them in.
Incognito has just come out. What next?
I'm finishing my next book, which is called Live Wired, and it's about how the brain is constantly rewiring its own circuitry. So it's not hardware, nor is it software, but it's what I call liveware. It's always reconfiguring itself, and we don't build machines like this. And so my next book is a real appeal to the future to take the tricks that Mother Nature is doing under the hood and start implementing them in the way that we build things.
Can't wait. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you.
David Eagleman's book, Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, is out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, at Science Weekly, we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow at Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Now, making its second appearance on the podcast, which means it's lasted much longer than some of our previous features, it's time for the Hannaford question. This was posed by one of our listeners, Rob Hannaford, who wanted us to ask everyone on the podcast the same thing.
If you had one question that you could have answered, what would it be?
Last week, Brian Cox wanted to know why the universe started in such a highly ordered state. And here's this week's big question.
Hi, I'm Brian Green, professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. And one question that I would love to have the answer to is, what is the true nature of time? Time is something that governs our lives. It's what gives us a poignancy to existence. What is time? Where did it come from? Is it made of something finer, just like a table is made up of molecules and atoms? Is time made up of some sort of atoms of time? That is the question that I'd love to have an answer to.
Feel free to give your best shot at answering it on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Next, let's celebrate a true milestone in human history. It's the 50th anniversary of the first flight into space.
Science Weekly.
So my name's Chris Riley, and I'm the producer and director of the new film called First Orbit, which recreates Gagarin's pioneering spaceflight 50 years ago. So this Tuesday morning, Tuesday the 12th of April, is the 50th anniversary of Gagarin's flight. And in fact, at exactly 07:07 British summer time in the morning is the exact time that Gagarin lifted off from Baikonur 50 years ago on his first space flight. So the film that we've created, First Orbit, is designed to be played at exactly this time. It will run in exact real time through Gagarin's flight. The mission audio is placed in the right place, and the pictures, the new pictures that we've filmed from on board the International Space Station, matching up the orbit of the space station to Vostok 1's original orbit in terms of the ground path and the time of day, so the sun angles are right. All those pictures run concurrently with Gagarin's original mission audio so that you can get a full experience of what Gagarin was seeing and feeling and talking about exactly 50 years to the second after it happened. So we've made this film to give away online, to share freely with everybody around the world in the spirit that the original spaceflight was done itself. So you can watch the film by going to the website firstorbit.org, O-R-G, or going to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/firstorbit, and also here on The Guardian's website, guardian.co.uk/science. The idea for this film came to me about a year ago when they put the brand new giant window into the International Space Station, this beautiful cupola designed in Italy, the largest window ever constructed and put into a spacecraft. And I suddenly thought, you know, gosh, what could we use this brand new beautiful view of the Earth for in a sort of practical way? And I'd always been rather saddened by the fact that the archive film of Gagarin's pioneering flight was really somewhat lacking. There were a few shots of his face and his head as he was going through the kind of launch phase and flying over Siberia, but nothing of the view of Earth that he had. And so it suddenly just put these things together and thought, well, maybe we could film a new view of what Gagarin first saw 50 years ago. Now, at that time, I didn't even know whether it was possible, so I contacted the European Space Agency to ask them to do the maths on it, to solve that question, to see whether or not the space station did ever cover the same ground path as Vostok 1. And it turned out that actually it did, and we got opportunities to film at the right time of day over the right bit of the ground, or right bit of the Earth, about every 6 weeks. So we started to submit applications for time on board the space station to use crew time to film during these opportunities. And we got the footage back into the cutting room earlier this year, so in 2011. So it took almost a year from coming up with the idea to actually kind of getting hold of the footage. So just to remind you all, Tuesday the 12th of April at 07:07 British Summer Time, the 50th anniversary of Gagarin's flight in real time at guardian.co.uk/science. And if you aren't able to get up in time to watch it live, as it were, then the film will be available on that channel and on YouTube at youtube.com/firstorbit for the rest of April. And if you want to join in the big Yuri Gagarin conversation that we're going to be carrying on throughout the mission on Twitter, the hashtag will be Orbit1.
That's it for another week. My thanks to David Eagleman, Chris Riley, and Brian Green. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast while you're there, so every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. Links to everything you've heard can also be found on our Facebook group. Just search for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.